Side 11, A Fire Upon the Deep, by Werner Vinge. Continuing on page 240. We run on a nest of wolves. His speech was awkward, slurred. It must be between here and path above, a lump, like a little castle tower. Got a kill nest. Can you see it? Evidently, he could not. He was looking all over. Johanna looked back up the hillside. There seemed to be less fighting now, just sounds of tinish agony. Johanna pointed.
You mean there, that dark thing?
Pilgrim didn't answer. His members were twitching, his mouth knives waving randomly. She leaped away from the flashing metal. He had already cut himself. Sound attack! She looked back along the path. She'd had more than a year to know the packs, and what she was seeing now was madness. Some packs were exploding, racing in all directions to distances where thought couldn't possibly be sustained. Others, Woodcarver on her cart, huddled in heaps with scarcely a head showing. Just beyond the nearest uphill trees, she could see a gray tide. The wolves. Each furry lump looked innocent enough. Altogether, Johanna froze for an instant, watching them tear off the throat of a trooper's member. Johanna was the only sane person left, and all it would mean is she would know she was dying. Kill the nest. On the gun cart beside her, only one of Scrupolo was left, old Whitehead. Daffy as ever, it had pulled down its gunner's muffs and was nosing around under the gun tube. Kill the nest. Maybe not so daffy after all. Johanna jumped up on the wagon. It rolled back toward the drop-off, banging against a tree. She scarcely noticed. She pulled up the gun barrel, just as she had seen in all the drills. The white-headed one pulled at the powder bag, but with just his one pair of jaws, he couldn't handle it. Without the rest of its pack, it had neither hands nor brains. It looked up at her, its eyes wide and desperate. She grabbed the other end of the bag, and the two of them got the powder into the barrel. Whitehead dived back into the equipment, nosing around for a cannonball. Smarter than a dog and trained. Between them, maybe they had a chance. Just half a meter beneath her feet, the wolves were running by. One or two she could have fought off herself. But there were dozens down there, worrying and tearing at random members. Three of Pilgrim were standing around Scarbutt and the pups, but their defense was unthinking slashing. The pack had dropped its mouth knives and tines. She and Whitehead got the round down the barrel. Whitehead whipped back to the rear, began playing with the little wick lighter the gunners used. It was something that could be held in a single mouth, since only one member actually fired the weapon.
Wait, you idiot! Johanna kicked him back. We gotta aim this thing.
Whitehead looked hurt for an instant. The complaint wasn't completely clear to him. He had dropped the standoff wand, but still held the lighter. He flicked on the flame and circled determinedly back, tried to worm past Johanna's legs. She pushed him back again and looked uphill. The dark thing. That must be the nest. She tilted the gun tube on its mounting and sighted down the top. Her face ended up just centimeters from the persistent Whitehead and his flame. His muffed head darted forward and the flame touched the fire hole. The blast almost knocked Johanna off the cart. For a moment she could think of nothing but the pain that stabbed into her ears. She rolled to a sitting position, coughing in the smoke. She couldn't hear anything beyond a high-pitched ringing that went on and on. Their little wagon was teetering, one wheel hanging over drop-off. Whitehead was flopping around under the butt of the cannon. She pushed it off him and patted the muffed head. He was bleeding, or she was. She just sat dazed for a few seconds, mystified by the blood, trying to imagine how she had ever ended up here. A voice somewhere in the back of her head was screaming, "No time, no time." She forced herself to her knees and looked around, memories coming back painfully slow. There were splintered trees uphill of them. The blonde wood glinted among the leaves. Beyond them, where the nest had been, she saw a splash of fresh turned earth. They had killed it, but the fighting continued. There were still wolves on the path, but now they were the ones running in all directions. As she watched, dozens of them catapulted off the edge of trail into the trees and rocks below. And the Tines were actually fighting now. Pilgrim had picked up his knives. The blades and his muzzles dripped red as he slashed. Something gray and bleeding flew over the edge of the cart and landed by Johanna's leg. The wolf couldn't have been more than 20 centimeters long, its hair dirty gray-brown. It really did look like a pet, but the tiny jaws clicked at her ankles with murderous intent. Johanna dropped a cannonball on it. During the next 3 days, while Woodcarver's people struggled to bring their equipment and themselves back together, Johanna learned quite a bit about the wolves. What she and Scrupulo's Whitehead did with the cannon had stopped the attack cold. Without doubt, knocking out the nest had saved a lot of lives and the expedition itself. The wolves were a type of hive creature, only a little like the pack. The Tines race used group thought to reach high intelligence. Johanna had never seen a rational pack of more than 6 members. The wolf nests didn't care about high intelligence. Woodcarver claimed that a nest might have thousands of members. Certainly the one they'd tripped over was huge. Such a mob couldn't be as smart as a human. In terms of raw reasoning power, it probably wasn't much brighter than a single pack member. On the other hand, it could be a lot more flexible. Wolves could operate alone at great distances. When within 100 meters of the home nest, they were appendages of the queen members of the nest, and no one doubted their canniness then. Pilgrim had legends of nests with almost packish intelligence, of foresters who made treaties with nearby nests for protection in return for food. As long as the high-powered noises in the nest lived, the worker wolves could coordinate almost like Tine members. But kill the nest, and the creature fell apart like some cheap center topology network. Certainly, this nest had done a number on Woodcarver's army. It had waited quietly until the troopers were within its inner loudness. Then outlying wolves had used synchronized mimicry to create sonic ghosts, tricking the packs into turning from the nest and shooting uselessly into the trees. And when the ambush actually began, the nest had screamed concentrated confusion down on the Tines. That attack had been a far more powerful thing than the stink noise they'd encountered in other parts of the forest. To the Tines, the stinkers had been painfully loud and sometimes even frightening, but not the mind-destroying chaos of the wolf nest attack. More than 100 packs had been knocked out in the ambush. Some, mostly packs with pups, had huddled. Others, like Scrupulo, had been blasted apart. In the hours following the attack, many of these fragments straggled back and reassembled. The resulting Tines were shaken but unharmed. Intact soldiers hunted up and down the forested cliffs for injured members of their comrades. There were places along the drop-off that were more than 20 meters deep. Where their fall wasn't cushioned by tree boughs, members landed on naked rock. 5 dead ones were eventually found, and another 20 seriously injured. 2 carts had fallen. They were kindling, and their care hogs were too badly injured to survive. By great good luck, the gunshot had not started a forest fire. 3 times the sun made its vast, tilted course around the sky. Woodcarver's army recovered in a camp in the depths of the valley forest by the river. Vendacious had posted lookouts with signaling mirrors on the northern valley wall. This place was about as safe as any they could find so far north. It was certainly one of the most beautiful. It didn't have the view of the high forest, but there was the sound of the river nearby, so loud it drowned the sighing of the dry wind. The lowland trees didn't have root flowers, but they were still different from what Johanna had known. There was no underbrush, just a soft bluish moss that Pilgrim claimed was actually part of the trees. it stretched like mown parkland to the edge of the river. On the last day of their rest, the queen called a meeting of all the packs, not at guard or lookout. It was the largest collection of tines Johanna had seen in one place since her family was killed. Only these packs weren't fighting. As far as Johanna could see across the bluish moss, there were packs, each at least 8 meters from its nearest neighbor. For an absurd instant, she was reminded of Settlers Park at Overby. Families picnicking on the grass, each with its own traditional blanket and food lockers. But these families were each a pack, and this was a military formation. The rows were gently curving arcs, all facing toward the queen. Peregrine Wickrackscar was 10 meters behind her in shadow. Being queen's consort didn't count for anything official. On Woodcarver's left lay the living casualties of the ambush, members with bandages and splints. In some ways, such visible damage wasn't the most horrifying. There were also what Pilgrim called the walking wounded. These were singletons and duos and trios that were all that was left of whole packs. Some of these tried to maintain a posture of attention, but others mooned about, occasionally breaking into the queen's speech with aimless words. It was like Scriber Jacques Ramathan all over again, but most of these would live. Some were already melding, trying to make new individuals. Some of these might even work out, as Peregrine Wickrackscar had done. For most, it would be a long time before they were fully people again. Johanna sat with Scrupolo in the first rank of troopers before the queen. The commander of cannoneers stood at Tynish Parade Rest, rumps on the ground, chest high, most heads facing front. Scroop had come through it without serious damage. His white head had a few more scorch marks, and one of the other members had sprained a shoulder falling off the path. He wore his flying cannoneer muffs as flamboyantly as always, but there was something subdued about him. Maybe it was just the military formation and getting a medal for heroism. The queen was wearing her special jackets. Each head looked out at a different section of her audience. Johanna still couldn't understand Tynish and would certainly never speak it without mechanical assistance. But the sounds were mostly within her range of hearing. Low frequencies carry a lot better than high ones. Even without memory aids and grammar generators, she was learning a little. She could recognize emotional tone easily in things like the raucous arc, arc, arc that passed for applause around here. As for individual words, well, they were more like chords, single syllables that had meaning. Nowadays, if she listened really carefully, and Pilgrim weren't nearby to give a running translation, she could even recognize some of those. Just now, for instance, Woodcarver was saying good things about her audience. Approving arc-arcs came from all directions. They sounded like a bunch of semels. One of the queen's heads dipped into a bowl, coming up with a small carven doodad in its mouth. She spoke a pack's name, a multi-chord tum-ti-ti-tum, that if Johanna heard often enough, she might be able to repeat as Jacques Ramathan, or even see meaning in as Wickrackscar. From the front rank of the audience, a single member trotted toward the queen. It stopped practically nose to nose with the queen's nearest member. Woodcarver said something about bravery, and then two of her fastened the wooden brooch to the member's jacket. It turned smartly and returned to its pack. Woodcarver picked out another decoration and called on another pack. Johanna leaned over toward Scrupolo. "What's going on?" she said wonderingly. "Why are single members getting medals? And how can they stand to get so near another pack?" Scrupolo had been standing more stiffly at attention than most packs and was pretty much ignoring her. Now he turned one head in her direction. "Shh!" He started to turn back, but she grabbed him by one of his jackets. "Foolish one," he finally replied. "The award is for the whole pack. One member is extended to accept. More would be madness." One after another, three more packs extended a member to take their decorations.
Some were full of precision, like human soldiers in stories. Others started out smartly, then became timid and confused as they approached Woodcarver. Finally, Johanna said, "St, Scrupolo, when do we get ours?" This time he didn't even look at her. All his heads faced rigidly toward the Queen. "Last, of course. You and I killed the nest and saved Woodcarver herself." His bodies were almost shaking with the intensity of their brace. He's scared witless. And suddenly Johanna guessed why. Apparently Woodcarver had no problem maintaining her mind with one outside member nearby. But the reverse would not be true. Sending one of yourself into another pack meant losing some consciousness and placing trust in that other pack. Looking at it that way, well, it reminded Johanna of the historical novels she used to play. On Nuyora, during the Dark Age, ladies traditionally gave their sword to their queen when granted audience and then knelt. It was a way to swear loyalty. Same thing here, except that looking at Scrupolo, Johanna realized that even as a matter of form, the ceremony might be damn frightening. Three more medals bestowed, and then Woodcarver gobbled the cords that were Scrupolo's name. The commander of cannoneers went absolutely rigid, made faint whistling noises through his mouths.
"Johanna Orschendott," said Woodcarver,
then more tinish, something about coming forward. Johanna stood up, but not one of Scrupolo moved. The queen made a human laugh. She was holding two polished brooches.
"I'll explain all in Somnorsh later, Johanna. Just come forward with one of Scrupolo." "Scrupolo?"
Suddenly they were the center of attention with thousands of eyes watching. There was no more arcing or background chatter. Johanna hadn't felt so exposed since she played first colonist in her school's landing play. She leaned down so that her head was close to one of Scrupolo's.
"Come on, guy. We're the big heroes."
The eyes that looked back at her were wide.
"I can't."
The words were almost inaudible. For all his jaunty cannoneer muffs and standoffish manner, Scrupolo was terrified. But for him it wasn't stage fright.
"I can't tear me apart so soon. I can't."
There was murmured gobbling in the ranks behind them. Scrupolo's own cannoneers. By all the powers, would they hold this against him? Welcome to the Middle Ages. Stupid people. Even cut to pieces, Scrupolo had saved their behinds, and now... She put her hands on two of his shoulders.
"We did it before, you and I. Remember?"
The heads nodded.
"Some. That one part of me alone could never have done it."
"Right, and neither could I. But together we killed a wolf nest."
Scrupolo stared at her a second, eyes wavering.
"Yes, we really did."
He came to his feet, frisked his head so the cannoneer muffs flapped.
"Yes."
And he moved his white-headed one closer to her. Johanna straightened. She and Whitehead walked out into the open space. 4 meters. 6. She kept the fingertips of one hand lightly on his neck. When they were about 12 meters from the rest of Scrupolo, Whitehead's pace faltered. He looked sideways up at Johanna, then continued more slowly. Johanna didn't remember much of the ceremony, so much of her attention was on Whitehead. Woodcarver said something long and unintelligible. Somehow they both ended up with intricately carven decorations on their collars and were headed back toward the rest of Scrupolo. Then she was aware of the crowd once more. They stretched as far as she could see under the forest canopy, and every one of them seemed to be cheering, Scroop's cannoneers loudest of all. Midnight. Here at the bottom of the valley, there were 3 or 4 hours of the day around when the sun dipped behind the high north wall. It didn't much feel like night or even twilight. The smoke from the fires to the north seemed to be getting worse. She could smell it now.
Johanna walked back from the cannoneer's section toward the center of camp and woodcarver's tent.
It was quiet. She could hear little creatures scritching in the root bushes. The celebrating might have gone on longer, except that everyone knew that in another few hours they would be preparing for the climb up the valley's north wall. So now there was only occasional laughter and occasional pack walking about. Johanna walked barefoot, her shoes slung over her shoulders. Even in the dry weather, the moss was wonderfully soft between her toes. Above her, the forest canopy was shifting green and patches of hazy sky. She could almost forget what had gone before and what lay ahead. The guards around Woodcarver's tent didn't challenge her, just called softly ahead. After all, there weren't that many humans running around. The queen stuck out ahead.
"Come inside, Johanna."
Inside, she was sitting in her usual circle, the puppies protected in the middle. It was quite dark, the only light being what came through the entrance. Johanna flopped down on the pillows where she usually slept. Ever since this afternoon, the big award thing, she had been planning to give Woodcarver a piece of her mind. Now, well, the party at the cannoneer's had been a happy thing. It seemed kind of a shame to break the mood. Woodcarver cocked a head at her. Simultaneously, the two puppies duplicated the gesture.
"I saw you at the party. You are a sober one. You eat most of our foods now, but none of the beer."
Johanna shrugged.
"Yes. Why?"
"Kids aren't supposed to drink before they're 18 years old."
That was the custom, and her parents had agreed with it. Johanna had turned 14 a couple of months ago. Dataset had reminded her of the exact hour. She wondered, if none of this had happened, if she were still back at the High Lab or Stroumly Rome, would she be sneaking out with friends to try such forbidden things? Probably. Yet here, where she was entirely on her own, where she was currently a big hero, she hadn't tried a drop. Maybe it was because Mom and Dad weren't here, and following their wishes seemed to keep them closer. She felt tears coming to her eyes. Woodcarver didn't seem to notice.
"That's what Pilgrim said was the reason."
She tapped at her puppies and smiled.
"I guess it makes sense. These two don't get beer till they're older, though I know they got some second-hand partying from me tonight."
There was a hint of beer breath in the tent. Johanna wiped roughly at her face. She really did not want to talk about being a teenager just now.
"You know, that was kind of a mean trick you pulled on Scrupolo this afternoon."
Yes. I talked to him about it beforehand. He didn't want it, but I thought he was just being... Is stiff-necked the word? If I had known how upset he was, well, he practically fell apart out there in front of everybody. If I understand how things work, that would have been his disgrace, right?"
"Yes. Exchanging honor for loyalty in front of peers, it's an important thing. At least the way I run things. I'm sure Pilgrim or Datasec can say a dozen other ways to lead." "Look, Johanna, I needed that exchange, and I needed you and Scrupolo to be there."
"Yeah, I know. We two saved the day."
"Silence!"
Her voice was suddenly edged, and Johanna remembered that this was a medieval queen.
"We are 200 miles north of my borders, almost to the heart of the Flenser domain. In a few days we will meet the enemy, and many more of us will die, for we know not quite what."
The bottom dropped out of Johanna's stomach. If she couldn't get back to the ship, couldn't finish what Mom and Dad had started...
"Please, Woodcarver, it is worth it."
"I know that. Pilgrim knows it. The majority of my council agrees, though grudgingly. But we of the council have talked with Dataset. We've seen your worlds and what your science can do. On the other hand, most of my people here..."
She waved ahead at the camp beyond the tent.
"Are here on faith and out of loyalty to me. For them,
The situation is deadly, and the goal is vague."
She paused, though her two pups continued gesturing forcefully for a second.
"Now, I don't know how you would persuade your kind to take such risks. Dataset talks of military conscription."
"That was New Yora, long ago."
"Never mind. The point is, my troops are here out of loyalty, mostly to me personally. For 600 years I have protected my people well. Their memories and legends are clear on it. More than once I was the only one who saw a peril, and it was my advice that saved all those who heeded it. That is what keeps most of the soldiers, most of the cannoneers going. Each of them is free to turn back. So, what should they think when our first combat is to fall like ignorant tourists onto a nest of wolves? Without the great good luck of you and part of Scrupolo being at the right place and alert, I would have been killed. Pilgrim would have been killed. Perhaps a third of the soldiers would have died. If not us, perhaps someone else," Johanna said in a small voice.
"Perhaps. I don't think anyone else came close to firing on the nest. You see the effect on my people?
If bad luck in the forest can kill our queen and destroy our marvelous weapons, what will it be like when we face a thinking enemy?"
That was the question in many minds. Unless I could answer it, we'd never make it out of this valley, at least not going northward.
"So you gave them medals, loyalty for honor?"
"Yes."
"You missed the sense of it, not understanding Tynish. I made a big thing of how well they had done. I gave Silverwood accolades to packs who showed any competence in the ambush. That helped some. I repeated my reasons for this expedition, the wonders that Dataset describes, and how much we will lose if Steele gets his way. But they've heard that argument before, and it points to far away things they can scarcely imagine. The new thing I showed them today was you and Scrupolo."
"Us?"
"I praised you beyond the skies. Singletons often do brave things. Sometimes they are halfway clever, or talk as though they are. But alone, Scrupolo's fragment wouldn't be much more than a good knife fighter. He knew about using the cannon, but he didn't have the paws or mouths to do anything with it. And by himself, he would never have figured out where to shoot it. You, on the other hand, are a two-legs. In many ways, you are helpless. The only way you can think is by yourself, but you can do it without interfering with those around you. Together, you did what no pack could do in the middle of a wolf-nest attack. So I told my army what a team our two races could become, how each makes up for the age-old failings of the other. Together, we are one step closer to being the pack of packs. How is Scrupolo?"
Johanna smiled faintly.
"Things turned out okay. Once he was able to get out there and accept his medal..."
She fingered the brooch that was pinned to her own collar. It was a beautiful thing, a landscape of Woodcarver City.
"Once he'd done that, he was totally changed. You should have seen him with the cannoneers afterwards. They did their own loyalty honor thing, and then they drank a lot of beer. Scrupolo was telling them all about what we were doing. He even had me help demonstrate. You really think the army bought what you said about humans and Tynes?"
"I think so.
In my own language, I can be very eloquent. I've bred myself to be."
Woodcarver was silent for a moment. Her puppies scrambled across the carpet and patted their muzzles at Johanna's hands.
"Besides, it may even be true. Pilgrim is sure of it. You can sleep in the same tent with me and still think.
That's something that he and I can't do. In our own ways, we've each lived a long time, and I think we are each at least as smart as the humans and other creatures that Dataset talks about in the beyond.
But you singleton creatures can stand next to each other and think and build. Compared to us, I'll bet singleton races developed the sciences very fast. But now, with your help, maybe things will change fast for us, too."
The two puppies retreated, and Woodcarver lowered heads to pause.
"That's what I told my people, anyway.
You should try to get some sleep now."
On the ground beyond the tent's entrance, there were already splashes of sunlight.
"Okay."
Johanna slipped off her outer clothes. She lay down and dragged a light quilt across herself. Most of Woodcarver already looked asleep. As usual, one or two pairs of eyes were open, but their intelligence would be limited, and just now even they looked tired. Funny. Woodcarver had worked with dataset so much, her human voice had come to capture emotion as well as pronunciation. Just now she had sounded so tired, so sad. Johanna reached out from under her quilt to brush the neck of Woodcarver's nearest, the blind one.
"Do you believe what you told everyone?"
she said softly. One of the sentry heads looked at her, and a very human sigh seemed to come from all directions. Woodcarver's voice was very faint.
"Yes, but I am very afraid that it doesn't matter anymore. For 600 years I have had proper confidence in myself, but what happened on the south wall should not have happened. It would not if I had followed Vendacious's advice and come down on the new road."
"But we might have been seen."
"Yes. A failure either way, don't you see? Vendacious has precise information from the highest councils of the Flenser. But he's something of a careless fool in everyday matters. I knew that and thought I could compensate. But the old road was in far worse condition than I remembered. The wolf nest could never have settled by it if there had been any traffic during the last few years. If Endacious had managed his patrols properly, or if I had been managing him properly, we would never have been surprised. Instead, we were nearly overrun. And my only remaining talent appears to be in fooling those who trust me into thinking I still know what I'm doing." She opened another pair of eyes and made the smile gesture. "Strange. I haven't said these things even to Pilgrim. Is this another advantage of human relations?"
Johanna patted the blind one's neck.
"Maybe. Anyway, I believe what I said about things that could be, but I fear that my soul may not be strong enough to make them so. Perhaps I should turn things over to Pilgrim or Vendacious. That's something I must think on."
Woodcarver shhed Johanna's surprised protests.
"Now sleep, please."
Chapter 32. There was a time when Ravna thought their tiny ship might fly all the way to the bottom unnoticed. Along with everything else, that had changed. At the moment, Out of Band 2 might be the most famous starship known to the net. 1,000,000 races watched the chase. In the middle beyond, there were vast antenna swarms beaming in their direction and listening to the stories, mostly lies, sent from the ships that pursued the OOB. She couldn't hear those lies directly, of course, but the transmissions she received were as clear as if they were on a main trunk. Ravna spent part of each day reading the news, trying to find hope, trying to prove to herself that she was doing the right thing. By now she was pretty sure Watt was chasing them. No doubt even Farm and Blue Shell would have agreed on that. Why they were being chased, and what they might find at the end, was now the subject of endless speculation on the net. As usual, whatever the truth might be, was well hidden among the lies. Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc. Language Path, Triskwayline SJK Units. From Hans. No references prior to the fall of Relay. No probable source. This is someone being very cautious. Subject, Alliance for the Defense Fraudulent? Distribution. Threat of the Blight, War Trackers Interest Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group. Date, 5.80 days since fall of Chandra K. Key phrases. Fool's errand. Unnecessary genocide. Text of message. Earlier, I speculated that there had been no destruction at Chandra K. Apologies. That was based on a catalog identification error. I agree with the messages. 13,123 as of a few seconds ago, assuring me that the habitations of Chandra K suffered collisional damage within the last 6 days.
So apparently the Alliance for the Defense has taken the military action they claimed earlier, and apparently they are powerful enough to destroy small civilizations in the middle beyond.
The question still remains, why? I have already posted arguments showing it unlikely that Homo sapiens is especially controllable by the Blight, though they were stupid enough to create that entity. Even the Alliance's own reports admit that less than half of Chandra K's sophants were of that race. Now a large part of the Alliance fleet is chasing into the bottom of the beyond after a single ship. What conceivable damage can the Alliance do to the Blight down there? The Blight is a great threat, perhaps the most novel and threatening and well-recorded history. Nevertheless, Alliance behavior appears destructive and pointless. Now that the Alliance has revealed some of its sponsoring organizations, see messages, ID numbers, I think we know its real motives. I see connections between the Alliance and the old Aprahant hegemony. 1,000 years ago, that group undertook a similar jihad, grabbing real estate left vacant by recent transcendences. Stopping the hegemony was an exciting bit of action in that part of the galaxy. I think these people are back, taking advantage of the general panic attending the Blight, which is admittedly a much greater threat. My advice, beware of the Alliance and its claims of heroic efforts.
Crypto Zero, as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc, Language Path, Skirakine to Rondralip to Trisqualine, SJK Units, from Harmonious Repose Communications Synod. Subject, Encounter with Agents of the Perversion.
Distribution, Threat of the Blight. Date, 6.37 days since fall of Chandra K. Key phrases, Hance Fraudulent. Text of message. We have no special inclination toward any of the posters on this thread. Nevertheless, it's remarkable that an entity that has not revealed its location or special interests, namely Hance, should be smearing the efforts of the Alliance for the Defense. The Alliance kept its constituents secret only during that period when its forces were being gathered, when a single stroke of the perversion's power might destroy it entirely. Since that time, it has been quite open in its efforts. Hance wonders how a single starship could be worth the Alliance's attention. As Harmonious Repose was the side of the latest turn of events, we are in a position to give some explanation. The ship in question, the Out of Band 2, is clearly designed for operations at the bottom of the beyond, and is even capable of limited operations within the slow zone. The ship presented itself as a special zonographic flight commissioned to study the recent turbulence at the bottom. In fact, this ship's mission is a very different one. In the aftermath of its violent departure, we have pieced together some extraordinary facts. At least one of the ship's crew was human. Though they made great efforts to stay out of view and used Scrotorider traders as intermediaries, we have recordings. A biosequence of one individual was obtained, and it matches the patterns maintained by 2 out of 3 of the Homo sapiens archives. It's well known that the third archive on Snayrote Down is in the control of human sympathizers. Some might say this deception was founded in fear. After all, these events happened after the destruction of Chandra K. We think otherwise. The ship's initial contact with us occurred before the Chandra K incident. We have since made a careful analysis of the repair work our yards performed on this vessel.
Ultra-drive automation is a deep and complex thing. Even the cleverest of cloaking cannot mask all the memories in it. We now know that the out-of-band 2 was from the relay system and that it left there after the perversion's attack. Think what this means. The crew of the out-of-band 2 brought weapons into a habitat, killed several local sophants, and escaped before our musicians, harmonizers, police, were properly notified. We have good reason to wish them ill. Yet our misfortune is a small thing compared to the unmasking of this secret mission. We are very grateful that the Alliance is willing to risk so much in following this lead. There's more than the usual number of unsubstantiated assertions floating around on this news thread. We hope our facts will wake some people up. In particular, consider what Hance may really be. The perversion is very visible in the high beyond, where it has great power and can speak with its own voice. Down here, it is more likely that deception and covert propaganda will be its tools. Think on this when you read postings from unidentified entities such as Hans. Ravna gritted her teeth. The hell of it was, the facts in the posting were correct. It was the inferences that were vicious and false.
And she couldn't guess if this were some shade of black propaganda or simply St. Rindell expressing honest conclusions, though Rindell had never seemed so trusting of the butterflies.
One thing all the news seemed to agree on. Much more than the Alliance fleet was chasing the OOB. The swarm of ultra-drive traces could be seen by anyone within 1,000 light-years. The best guess was that 3 fleets pursued the OOB. 3. The Alliance for the Defense, still loud and boastful, even though suspected by some of being opportunistic genocides. Behind them, Chandra K., and what was left of Ravna's motherland, in all the universe, perhaps the only folk she could trust. And just behind them, the Silent Fleet. Diverse news posters claimed it was from the high beyond. That fleet might have problems at the bottom, but for now it was gaining. Few doubted that it was the perversion's child. More than anything, it convinced the universe that the OOB, or its destination, was cosmically important. Just why it was important was the big question. Speculation was drifting in at the rate of 5,000 messengers per hour. 1,000,000 different viewpoints were considering the mystery.
Some of those viewpoints were so alien that they made scrutinizers and humans look like the same species.
At least 5 participants on this news thread were gaseous inhabitants of stellar coronas. There were 1 or 2 others that Ravna suspected were uncatalogued races, being so shy that this might be their first active use of the net ever. The OOB's computer was a lot dumber than it had been in the middle beyond. She couldn't ask it to sift through the messages looking for nuance and insight. In fact, if an incoming message didn't have a Trisk Wayline text, it was often unreadable. The ship's translator programs still worked fairly well with the major trade languages, but even there the translation was slow and full of alternative meanings and jabberwocky. It was just another sign that they were approaching the bottom of the beyond. Effective translation of natural languages comes awfully close to requiring a sentient translator program. Nevertheless, with proper design, things might have been better. The automation might have degraded gracefully under the restrictions imposed by their depth. Instead, gear just stopped working. What remained was slow and error-prone. If only the refitting had been completed before the fall of Relay. And just how many times have I wished for that? She hoped things were as bad aboard the pursuing ships. So Ravna used the ship to do light culling on the threat's news group. Much of what was left was inane, as from people who see portents in the weather. Crypto Zero. Syntax 43.
As received by OOB ship board ad hoc. Language path, Arbuth to Trade 24 to Chair Gwalin to Trisk Wayline, SJK units.
From Twirlip of the Mists. Perhaps an organization of cloud flyers in a single Jovian system. Very sparse priors before this thread began. Appears to be seriously out of touch. Program recommendation, delete this poster from presentation. Subject, the Blight's goal at the bottom. Distribution, threat of the Blight, great secrets of creation. Date, 4.54 days since fall of Chandrake. Key phrases, zone instability and the Blight, Hexapodia as the key insight. Text of message. Apologies first if I am repeating obvious conclusions. My only gateway onto the net is very expensive, and I miss many important postings. I think that anyone following both Great Secrets of Creation and Threat of the Blight would see an important pattern. Since the events reported by Harmonious Repose Information Service most agree that something important to the perversion exists at the bottom of the beyond in region ellipsis. I see a possible connection here with the Great Secrets. During the last 220 days, there have been increasing reports of zone interface instability in the region below Harmonious Repose. As the Blight threat has grown and its attacks against advanced races and other powers continued, this instability has increased. Could there not be some connection? I urge all to consult their information on the Great Secrets or the nearest archive maintained by that group. Events such as this prove once again that the universe is all Ronzel between. Some of the postings were tantalizing. Crypto Zero, Syntax 43,
as received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc. Language Path, Wobblings to Bailoresque to Trisqualine SJK Units.
From Cricket Song Under the High Willow. Cricket Song is a synthetic race created as a JAPE experiment instrument by the High Willow upon its transcendence. Cricket Song has been on the net for more than 10,000 years. Apparently, it is a fanatical studier of paths to transcendence. For 8,000 years, it has been the heaviest poster on Where Are They Now and related groups. There is no evidence that any Cricket Song settlement has itself transcended. Cricket Song is sufficiently peculiar that there is a large news group for speculation concerning the race itself. Consensus is that Cricket Song was designed by High Willow as a probe back into the beyond, that the race is somehow incapable of attempting its own transcendence. Subject, the Blight's goal at the bottom. Distribution, Threat of the Blight, Wartracker Special Interest Group, Where Are They Now Special Interest Group. Date, 5.12 days since fall of Chandrake. Key phrases, on becoming transcendent. Text of message. Contrary to other postings, there are a number of reasons why a power might install artifacts at the bottom of the beyond. The Absalor's message on this thread cites some. Some powers have documented curiosity about the slow zone and, even more, about the unthinking depth. In rare cases, expeditions have been dispatched, though any return from the depths would occur long after the dispatching power lost interest in all local questions.
However, none of these motives are likely here.
To those who are familiar with fast burn transcendence, it is clear that the Blight is a creature seeking stasis. Its interest in the bottom is very sudden, provoked, we think, by the revelations at Harmonious Repose. There is something at the bottom that is critical to the perversion's welfare. Consider the notion of ablative dissonance. See the Where Are They Now group archive. No one knows what setup procedures the humans of Straumli realm were using. The fast burn may itself have had transcendent intelligence. What if it became dissatisfied with the direction of the Chenedring? In that case, it might try to hide the jump-off birthing L.
The bottom would not be a place where the algorithm itself could normally execute, but avatars might still be created from it and briefly run.
Up to a point, Ravna could almost make sense of it. Ablative dissonance was a commonplace of applied theology. But then, like one of those dreams where the secret of life is about to be revealed, the posting just drifted into nonsense.
There were postings that were neither asinine nor obscure. As usual, Shandor at the zoo had a lot of things dead right. Crypto Zero. As received by OOB Shipboard Ad Hoc. Language Path, Trisqualine, SJK Units. From Shandor Arbitration Intelligence at the zoo. A known military corporation of the high beyond. If this is a masquerade, somebody is living dangerously. Subject: The Blight's goal at the bottom. Key phrases: sudden change in Blight's tactics. Distribution: threat of the Blight, War Tracker's interest group, Homo sapiens interest group. Date: 8.15 days since fall of Chandra K. Text of message: in case you don't know, Shandor Intelligence has a number of different net feeds. We can collect messages on paths that have no intermediate nodes in common. Thus, we can detect and correct tampering done en route. There remain the lies and misunderstandings that were present to begin with, but that's something that makes the intelligence business interesting. The Blight has been our top priority since its instantiation a year ago. This is not just because of the Blight's obvious strength, the destruction and the deicides it has committed. We fear that all this is the lesser part of the threat. There have been perversions almost as powerful in the recorded past. What truly distinguishes this one is its stability. We see no evidence of internal evolution. In some ways, it is less than a power. It may never lose interest in controlling the high beyond. We may be witnessing a massive and permanent change in the nature of things. Imagine a stable necrosis where the only sentience in the high beyond is the Blight. Thus, studying the Blight has been a matter of life and death for us, even though we are powerful and widely distributed. We've reached a number of conclusions. Some of these may be obvious to you, others may sound like flagrant speculation. All take on a new coloring with the events reported from Harmonious Repose. Almost from the beginning, the Blight has been searching for something. This search has extended far beyond its aggressive physical expansion. Its automatic agents have tried to penetrate virtually every node in the top of the beyond. The high network is in shambles, reduced to protocols scarcely more efficient than those known below. At the same time, the Blight has physically stolen several archives. We have evidence of very large fleets searching for off-net archives at the top and in the low transcend. At least three powers have been murdered in this rampage. And now, suddenly, this assault has ended. The Blight's physical expansion continues with no end in sight, but it no longer searches the high beyond. As near as we can tell, the change occurred about 2,000 seconds before the escape of the human vessel from Harmonious Repose. Less than 6 hours later, we saw the beginnings of the silent fleet that so many are now speculating about. That fleet is indeed the creature of the Blight. In other times, the destruction of Chandra K and the motives of the Alliance for the Defense would all be important issues, and our organization might have interest in doing business with those affected. But all that is dwarfed by the fact of this fleet and the ship it pursues. And we disagree with the analysis from Harmonious Repose. It is obvious to us that the Blight did not know of the Out of Band 2 until its discovery at Harmonious Repose. That ship is not a tool of the Blight, but it contains or is bound for something of enormous importance to the Blight. And what might that be? Here we begin frank speculation. And since we are speculating, we'll use those powerful pseudo-laws, the principles of mediocrity and minimal assumption. If the Blight has the potential for taking over all the top in a permanent stability, then why has this not happened before? Our guess is that the Blight has been instantiated before, with such dire consequence that the event marks the beginning of recorded time, but it has its own peculiar natural enemy. The order of events even suggests a particular scenario, one familiar from network security. Once upon a time, Very long ago, there was another instance of the blight. A successful defense was mounted, and all known copies of the blight's recipe were destroyed. Of course, on a wide net, one can never be sure that all copies of a badness are gone. No doubt, the defense was distributed in enormous numbers, but even if a harboring archive were reached by such a distribution, there might be no effect if the blight were not currently active there. The luckless humans of Stralmley Realm chanced on such an archive, no doubt a ruin long off the net. They instantiated the blight and, incidentally, perhaps a little later, the defense program. Somehow that blight's enemy escaped destruction. And the blight has been searching for it ever since, in all the wrong places. In its weakness, the new instance of the defense retreated to depths no power would think of penetrating, whence it could never return without outside help. Speculation on top of speculation. We can't guess the nature of this defense, except that its retreat is a discouraging sign. And now even that sacrifice has gone for naught, since the blight has seen through the deception. The blight's fleet is clearly an ad hoc thing, hastily thrown together from forces that happened to be closest to the discovery. Without such haste, the quarry might have been lost to it. Thus the chase equipment is probably ill-suited to the depths, and its performance will degrade as the descent progresses. However, we estimate that it will remain stronger than any force that can reach the scene in the near future. We may learn more after the blight reaches the out-of-band 2's destination. If it destroys that destination immediately, we'll know that something truly dangerous to the blight existed there, and may exist elsewhere, at least in recipe form. If it does not, then perhaps the blight was looking for something that will make it even more dangerous than before. Ravna sat back, stared at the display for some time. Shandor Arbitration Intelligence was one of the sharpest posters in this news group, but now even their predictions were just different flavors of doom. And all so damn cool they were, so analytical. She knew that Shandor was polyspecific with branch offices scattered through the high beyond, but they were no power. If the perversion could knock over Relay and kill Old One, then all of Shandor's resources wouldn't help it if the enemy decided to gobble them up. Their analysis had the tone of the pilot of a crashing ship, intent on understanding the danger, not taking time out for terror. "Oh, Fom, how I wish I could talk to you like before." She curled gently in on herself the way you can in zero-G. The sobs came softly, but without hope. They had not exchanged 100 words in the last 5 days. They lived as if with guns at each other's heads. And that was the literal truth. She had made it so. When she and he and the Scroter Riders had been together, at least the danger had been a shared burden. Now they were split apart, and their enemies were slowly gaining on them. What good could Fom's God-Shatter be against 1,000 enemy ships and the blight behind them? She floated for a timeless while, the sobs fading into despairing silence. And again she wondered if what she'd done could possibly be right. She had threatened Fom's life to protect Blueshell and Greenstalk and their kind. In doing so, she had kept secret what might be the greatest treachery in the history of the known net. Can one person make such a decision? Fom had asked her that, and she had answered, yes, but... The question toyed with her every day, and every day she tried to see some way out. She wiped her face silently. She didn't doubt what Fom had discovered. There were some smug posters on the net who argued that something as vast as the blight was simply a tragic disaster and not an evil. Evil, they argued, could only have meaning on smaller scales, and the hurt that one softened does to another. Before Rip, the argument had seemed a frivolous playing with words. Now she saw that it was meaningful and dead wrong. The blight had created the riders, a marvelous and peaceful race. Their presence on a billion worlds had been a good, and behind it all was the potential for converting the sovereign minds of friends into monsters. When she thought of Blueshell and Greenstalk, and the fear welled up, and she knew the poison that was there. Even though they were good people, then she knew she'd glimpsed evil on the transcendent scale. She had gotten Blueshell and Greenstalk into this mission. They had not asked for it. They were friends and allies, and she would not harm them because of what they could become. Maybe it was the latest news items. Maybe it was confronting the same impossibilities for the nth time. Ravna gradually straightened, looking at those last messages. So, she believed Fahm about the Schroderider threat. She also believed these two were only enemies in potential. She had thrown away everything to save them and their kind. Maybe it was a mistake. But take what advantage there is in it. If they are to be saved because you think they are allies, then treat them as allies. Treat them as the friends they are. We are all pawns together. Ravna pushed gently toward her cabin's doorway. The Schroderider's cabin was just behind the command deck. Since the debacle at Rip, the two had not left it. As she drifted down the passage toward their door, Ravna half expected to see Fahm's handiwork lurking in the shadows. She knew he was doing his best to protect himself. Yet there was nothing unusual. What will he think of my visiting them? She announced herself. After a moment, Blueshell appeared. His scrota was wiped clean of cosmetic stripes, and the room behind him was a jumble. He waved her in with quick jerks of his fronds. My lady?
Blueshell.
She nodded at him. Half the time she cursed herself for trusting the riders. The other half she was mortally embarrassed for having left them alone.
How is Greenstalk?
Surprisingly, Blueshell's fronds snapped together in a smile. You guessed? This is the first day with her new scrota. I will show you if you'd like. He threaded around equipment that was scattered in a lattice across the room. It was similar to the shop equipment Fahm had used to build his powered armor. And if Fahm had seen it, he might have lost all self-control. I've worked on it every minute since Fahm locked us in here. Greenstalk was in the other room. Her stalk and fronds rose from a silver pot. There were no wheels. It looked nothing like a traditional scrota. Blueshell rolled across the ceiling and extended a frond down to his mate. He rustled something at her, and after a moment she replied, The scrotaling is very limited. No mobility, no redundant power supplies. I copied it off a lesser scrotarider design, a simple thing designed by Dirachemes. It's not meant for more than sitting in one place, facing in one direction. But it provides her with short-term memory support and attention focusers. She is back with me. He fussed around her, some fronds caressing hers, others pointing to the gadget he had built for her. She herself was not badly injured. Sometimes I wonder, whatever Fahm says, maybe at the last second he could not kill her. He spoke nervously, as though afraid of what Ravna might say. The first few days I was very worried, but the surgeon is good. It gave her plenty of time to stand in strong serve, to think slowly. Since I've added on this scrotaling, she has practiced the calisthenics of memory, repeating what the surgeon or I say to her. With the scrotaling, she can hold on to a new memory for almost 500 seconds. That's usually long enough for her natural mind to commit a thought to long-term memory. Ravna drifted close. There were some new creases in Greenstalk's fronds. Those would be scars healing. Her visual surfaces followed Ravna's approach. The rider knew she was here. Her whole posture was friendly.
Can she talk Trisk, Blueshell? Do you have a voter hooked up?
What? Buzz. He was forgetful or nervous. Ravna couldn't tell which.
Yes, yes. Just give me a minute. There was no need before. No one wanted to talk to us. He fiddled with something on the homemade scrota. After a moment,
"Hello, Ravna. I recognize you."
Her fronds rustled in time with the words.
"I know you, too. I am glad that you are back."
The voder voice was faint, wistful.
"Yes, it's hard for me to tell. I do want to talk, but I'm not sure. Am I making sense?"
Out of Greenstalk's sight, Blueshell flicked a long tendril, a gesture. "Say yes."
"Yes, I understand you, Greenstalk."
And Ravna resolved never again to get angry with Greenstalk about not remembering.
"Good."
Her fronds straightened, and she didn't say anything more. "See?" came Blueshell's voder voice. "I am brightly cheerful. Even now, Greenstalk is committing this conversation to long-term memory. It goes slowly for now, but I am improving the scrotaling. I'm sure her slowness is mainly emotional shock." He continued to brush at Greenstalk's fronds, but she didn't say anything more. Ravna wondered just how brightly cheerful he could be. Behind the riders were a set of display windows customized now for the rider outlook.
"You've been following the news?" Ravna asked.
"Yes, indeed."
I feel so helpless.
"I feel so foolish saying that to you." But Blueshell didn't take offense. He seemed grateful for the change of topic, preferring the gloom at a distance. "Yes, we certainly are famous now. 3 fleets chasing us down, my lady. Ha ha."
"They don't seem to be gaining very fast."
Frond shrugged. "Sir Fom has turned out to be a competent ship's master. I'm afraid things will change as we descend. The ship's higher automation will gradually fail. What you call manual control will become very important. OOB was designed for my race, my lady. No matter what Sir Fom thinks of us, at bottom we can fly it better than any. So bit by bit the others will gain, at least those who truly understand their own ships."
Surely Fom must know this.
"I think he must, but he is trapped in his own fears. What can he do? If not for you, my lady Ravna, he might have killed us already. Maybe when the choice comes down to dying in the next hour against trusting us, maybe then there will be a chance."
"By then it will be too late. Look, even if he doesn't trust, even though he believes the worst of riders, there must still be a way."
And it came to her that sometimes you don't have to change the way people think or even whom they may hate.
"Fom wants to get to the bottom to recover this countermeasure. He thinks you may be from the Blight and after the same thing, but up to a point..."
"Up to a point he can cooperate, postpone the showdown he imagines till perhaps it won't matter." Even as she started to say it, Blueshell was already shouting back at her. "I am not of the Blight. Greenstalk is not. The rider race is not." He swept around his mate, rolled across the ceiling till his fronds rattled right before Ravna's face.
"I'm sorry. It's just the potential..."
"Nonsense." His voder buzzed off scale. "We ran into an evil few. Every race has such. People who will kill for trade. They forced Greenstalk, substituted Data at her voder. Fom Nguyen would kill our billions for the sake of this fantasy." He waved, inarticulate. Something she had never seen in a scrota rider. His fronds actually changed tone, darkened. The motion ceased, yet he said nothing more. And then Ravna heard it, a keening that might have come from a voder. The sound was steadily growing, a howl that made all Blueshell's sound effects friendly nonsense. It was Greenstalk. The scream reached a threshold just below pain, then broke into choppy Trisqualine.
"It's true. Oh, by all our trading, Blueshell, it's true."
And staticky noise came from her voder.
Her fronds started shaking, random turning that must be like a human's eyes wildly staring, like a human's mouth mumbling hysteria. Blueshell was already back by the wall, reaching to adjust her new scrota. Greenstalk's fronds brushed him away, and her voder voice continued,
"I was horror-struck, Blueshell. I was horror-struck, struck by horror, and it would not stop."
She was silent for a moment. Blueshell stood frozen.
"I remember everything up till the last 5 minutes, and everything Fom says is true, dear love. Loyal as you are, and I have seen that loyalty now for 200 years, you would be turned in an instant, just as I was."
Now that the dam broke, her words came quickly, mostly making sense. The horrors she could remember were graven deep, and she was finally coming out of ghastly shock.
"I was right behind you, remember, Blueshell? You were deep in your trading with the tusk legs, so deep you did not really see. I noticed the other riders coming toward us. No matter, a friendly meeting so far from home. Then one touched my scrota.
Greenstalk hesitated. Her fronds rattled, and she began again.
"Horror struck, horror struck."
After a moment,
"It was like suddenly new memories in the scrota, Blueshell. New memories, new attitudes, but thousands of years deep. And not mine. Instantly, instantly. I never even lost consciousness. I thought just as clearly. I remembered all I had before."
"And when you resisted?" Ravna said softly.
"Resisted? My Lady Ravna, I did not resist. I was theirs. No, not theirs, for they were owned too. We were things, our intelligence in service to another's goal, dead and alive to see our death. I would kill you. I would kill Fom. I would kill Blueshell. You know I tried. And when I did, I wanted to succeed. You could not imagine, Ravna. You humans speak of violation. You could never know."
Long pause.
"That's not quite right. At the top of the beyond, within the blight itself, perhaps there, everyone lives as I did."
The shuddering did not subside, but her gestures were no longer aimless. The fronds were saying something in her own language and brushing gently against Blueshell.
"Our whole race, dear love, just as Fom says it."
Blueshell wilted, and Ravna felt the sort of gut-tearing she had when they learned of Chandra Kay. That had been her worlds, her family, her life. Blueshell was hearing worse. Ravna pushed a little closer, near enough to run her hand up the side of Greenstalk's fronds.
"Fom says it's the greater scrotas that are the cause."
"Sabotage hidden billions of years deep."
"Yes, it is mainly the scrotas. The great gift we riders love so. It is a design for control, but I fear we were remade for it, too. When they touched my scrota, I was converted instantly. Instantly, everything I cared for was meaningless. We are like smart bombs scattered by the trillions through space that everyone thinks is safe. We will be used sparingly. We are the Blight's hidden weapon, especially in the low beyond."
Blueshell twitched, and his voice came out jerkily. "And everything Fom claims is correct."
"No, Blueshell, not everything."
Ravna remembered that last chilling standoff with Fom Nguyen.
"He has the facts, but he weighs them wrong. As long as your scrotas are not perverted, you are the same folk that I trusted to fly me to the bottom."
Blueshell angled his look away from her, an angry shrug. Greenstalk's voice came instead.
"As long as the scrota has not been perverted. But look how easy it was done, how sudden I became the Blight's."
"Yes, but could it happen except by direct touch? Could you be changed by reading the net news?"
She meant the question as ghastly sarcasm, but poor Greenstalk took it seriously.
"Not by a news item,
nor by standard protocol messages. But accepting a transmission targeted on Scrota utilities might do it.
Then we are safe here. You, because you no longer ride a greater Scrota. Blue Shell, because...
Because I was never touched. But how can you know that?
His anger was still there, deep within shame, but now it was a hopeless anger directed at something very far away.
No, dear love, you have not been touched. I would know.
Yes, but why should Ravna believe you?
Everything could be a lie, thought Ravna.
But I believe Greenstalk. I believe we four are the only ones in all the beyond who can hurt the Blight.
If only Fahm could see it. And that brought her back to...
You say we will start losing our lead?
Blueshell waved an affirmative. As soon as we are a little lower, they should have us in a matter of weeks.
And then it won't matter who was perverted and who was not.
I think we should have a little chat with Fahm Nguyen,
Godshatter and all. Beforehand, Ravna couldn't imagine how the confrontation would turn out. Just possibly, if he'd lost all touch with reality, Fahm might try to kill them when they appeared on the command deck. More likely, there would be rage and argument and threats, and they would be back to square one. Instead, it was almost like the old Fahm from before Harmonious Repose. He let them enter the command deck. He made no comment when Ravna set herself carefully between himself and the riders. He listened without interruption while Ravna explained what Greenstalk had said.
These two are safe, Fahm, and without their help, we'll not make it to the bottom.
He nodded, looked away at the windows. Some showed natural starscape. Most were ultra-trace displays, the closest thing to a picture of the enemies that were closing on the OOB. His calm expression broke for just an instant, and the Fahm that loved her seemed to stare out desperate.
And you really believe all this, Rav?
How? Then the lid was back on, his expression distant and neutral.
Never mind. Certainly it's true. Without all of us working together, we'll never make it to Tying's world. Blue Shell, I accept your offer. Subject to cautious safeguards, we work together.
Till I can safely dispose of you. Ravna could feel the unsaid words behind his blandness. Showdown deferred. Chapter 33. They were less than 8 weeks from Tying's world, both Fahm and Blue Shell said. If the zone conditions remained stable, if they were not overtaken in the meantime. Less than 2 months after the six already voyaged. But the days were not like before. Everyone was a challenge, a standoff sometimes cloaked in civility, sometimes flaring into threats of sudden death, as when Fahm retrieved Blue Shell's shop equipment. Fahm was living on the command deck now. When he left it, the hatch was locked on his ID. He had destroyed, or thought he had destroyed, all other privileged links to the ship's automation. He and Blue Shell were in almost constant collaboration, but not like before. Every step was slow, Blue Shell explaining everything, allowed to demonstrate nothing. That's where the arguments came closest to deadly force, when Fahm must give in to one peril or the other. For every day the pursuing fleets were a little bit closer. Two bands of killers, and what was left of Chandra K. Evidently, some of the SJK commercial security fleet could still fight, wanted revenge on the Alliance. Once Ravna suggested to Fahm that they contact commercial security, tried to persuade them to attack the Blight fleet. Fahm had given her a blank look.
Not yet. Maybe not ever, he said and turned away.
In a way, his answer was a relief. Such a battle would be a suicidal long shot. Ravna didn't want the last of her kinsfolk dying for her.
so the OOB might arrive at Tyne's World before the enemy, but with what little time to spare. Some days Ravna withdrew in tears and despair. What brought her back was Yefri and Greenstalk. They both needed her, and for a few weeks more she could still help. Mr. Steele's defense plans were proceeding. The Tynes were even having some success with their wideband radio. Steele reported that Woodcarver's main force was on its way north. There was more than one race against time. She spent many hours with the OOB's library devising more gifts for Yefri's friends. Some things, like telescopes, were easy, but others... It wasn't wasted effort. Even if the Blight won, its fleet might ignore the natives, might settle for killing the OOB and winning back the countermeasure. Greenstalk was slowly improving. At first, Ravna was afraid the improvement might be in her own imagination. Ravna was spending a good part of each day sitting with the writer trying to see progress in her responses. Greenstalk was very far away, almost like a human with stroke damage and prosthesis. In fact, she seemed regressed from the articulate horror of her first conversations. Maybe her recent progress was just a mirror to Ravna's sensitivity, to the fact that Ravna was with her so much. Blueshell insisted there was progress, but with that stubborn inflexibility of his. 2 weeks, three, and there was no doubt. Something was healing at the boundary between rider and scrotaling. Greenstalk consistently made sense, consistently committed important rememberings. Now, as often as not, it was she helping Ravna. Greenstalk saw things that Ravna had missed.
Sir Fahm isn't the only one who is afraid of us scrota riders. Blueshell is frightened, too, and it is tearing him apart. He can't admit it, even to me, but he thinks it's possible that we're infected independently of our scrotas. He desperately wants to convince Fahm that this is not true, and so to convince himself.
She was silent for a long moment, one frond brushing against Ravna's arm. Sea sounds surrounded them in the cabin, but ship's automation could no longer produce surging water.
Sigh. We must pretend the surf, dear Ravna. Somewhere it will always be, no matter what happened at Chandra Cay, no matter what happens here.
Blueshell was hearty gentleness around his mate, but alone with Ravna, his rage showed through.
No, no, I don't object to Sir Fahm's navigation, at least not now. Perhaps we could be a little further ahead with me directly at the helm, but the fastest ships behind us would still be closing. It's the other things, my lady. You know how untrustworthy our automation is down here. Fahm is hurting it further. He's written his own security overrides. He's turning the ship's environment automation into a system of booby traps.
Ravna had seen evidence of this. The areas around OOB's command deck and ship's workshop looked like military checkpoints.
You know his fears. If this makes him feel safer...
That's not the point, my lady. I would do anything to persuade him to accept my help. But what he's doing is deadly dangerous. Our bottom automation is not reliable, and he's making it actively worse. If we get some sudden stress, the environment programs will likely have a bizarre crash. Atmosphere dump, thermal runaway, anything. Doesn't he understand? Fahm controls nothing.
His voter broke into a nonlinear squawk.
He has the ability to destroy, but that is all. He needs my help. He was my friend. Doesn't he understand?
Fahm understood. Oh, Fahm understood. He and Ravna still talked. Their arguments were the hardest thing in her life. And sometimes they didn't exactly argue. Sometimes it was almost like rational discussion. I haven't been taken over, Ravna. Not like the Blight takes over riders, anyway. I still have charge of my soul. He turned away from the console and flashed a wan smile in her direction, acknowledging the flaw in such self-conviction. And from things like that smile,
Ravna was convinced that Fom Nguyen still lived and sometimes spoke.
What about the God-Shatter state? I see you for hours just staring at the tracking display or mucking around in the library and the news,
scanning faster than any human could consciously read. Fom shrugged. It's studying the ships that are chasing us, trying to figure out just what belongs to whom, just what capabilities each might have. I don't know the details. Self-awareness is on vacation, then. When all Fom's mind was turned into a processor for whatever programs Old One had downloaded, a few hours of fugue state might yield an instant of power-grade thought, and even that he didn't consciously remember. But I know this. Whatever the God Shatter is, it's a very narrow thing. It's not alive. In some ways, it may not even be very smart. For everyday matters like ship piloting, there's just good old Fom Nguyen.
There's the rest of us, Fom. Blue Shell would like to help. Ravna spoke softly.
This was the place where Fom would close into icy silence or blow up in rage. This day he just cocked his head. Ravna, Ravna, I know I need him. And I'm glad I need him, that I don't have to kill him. Yet. Fom's lips quivered for a second, and she thought he might start crying.
The God Shatter can't know Blue Shell.
Not the God Shatter. It's not making me act this way. I'm doing what any person should do when the stakes are this high. The words were spoken without anger. Maybe there was a chance. Maybe she could reason.
Blue Shell and Greenstalk are loyal, Fom, except at harmonious repose.
Fom sighed. Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. They came to Relay from Straumly Realm. They got Vrinimi looking for the refugee ship. That smells of setup, but probably unknowing. Maybe even a setup by something opposing the Blight. In any case, they were innocent then, else the Blight would have known about Tyne's world right from the beginning. The Blight knew nothing till Rip, till Greenstalk was converted. And I know Blue Shell was loyal even then. He knew things about my armor, the remotes, for instance, that he could have warned the others about.
Hope came as a surprise to Ravna. He really had thought things out, and... It's just the Scrotas, Fom. They're traps waiting to be sprung. But we're isolated here, and you destroyed the one, that Greenstalk.
Fom was shaking his head. End of Side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.